In this session, we're going to start the subject of neo-evangelicalism. Now, as sort of an introduction, let me review just very briefly where we've been lately. If you were going to study Christianity in the United States, what would you study? The denominations? And if you did, I mean, I began this segment talking about denominations, mainly how they were started, but what would you say about them? You'd maybe talk about how they grew or split or whatever, but there isn't a lot of, I guess if you were a member of a particular denomination, it would be of more interest. But, you know, in terms of history, what would you discuss? In the meantime, what happened is that originally, if you were in this country and you said you were a Christian, you believed the Bible. But in Europe, there was the development of classic liberalism. Now, classic liberalism was radical. It denied the supernatural, for example. So when professors here went over there to get prestigious degrees, they came back with their liberalism, taught it in the seminary. It took a while, took a generation or two for it to filter down to the pew. But so the real history of Christianity in America is theological more than chronological or denominational. So liberalism sort of penetrated the denominations. And those who understood what was happening, many of them started defending the basic truths of the Christian faith. In the latter part of the 19th century, in the 1800s, the latter part of that, as I explained, that was considered a theological position. And then it slowly, in the beginning of the 20th century, became a movement. And we talked about that in some detail. And so by 1920, it was called fundamentalism. But just to refresh your memory, fundamentalism started fighting to regain control of denominations, mainly the Presbyterian and the Baptist, and to, you know, gain control of missions. That was a big part of the deal. And they lost. They lost everything. And the epic loss was the Scopes trial. They actually won the Scopes trial, but it was a case of winning the battle and losing the war. That out of that came very negative impressions of fundamentalism throughout America, so that by 1930, they started separating from the denominations. So to understand what we're going to talk about in this session, you have to remember that little chronology. There was liberalism, and then there was fundamentalism that reacted against it. And oh, by the way, there was neo-orthodoxy that got in here that tried to get a little closer to the Bible, but it still wasn't teaching the fundamentals of the faith like Bible-believing Christians had done for centuries. So in that context, evangelicalism arose, only it's neo-evangelicalism, the new evangelicalism. So let me give an introduction of that and explain where it came from. The word evangelical is from the Greek word gospel. It was used during the Reformation for those who were opposed to the Roman Catholic Church. Luther would have called himself an evangelical. Today, in Europe, it is a synonym for being Protestant. In England, it's a designation of a theological conservative, both within and outside of the Church of England. So in America, it was used of the revivalism of the 19th century, Finney and Moody and, you know, later Billy Sunday, they were evangelical. So they were called fundamentalists, but as compared to liberalism, they would have been evangelical as well. In the 19th century, evangelical Protestantism was the dominant religious ideology in America. Remember that story I told when we were talking about fundamentalism, that one reporter said, I forgot the exact thing, if you were on a train traveling across America and you threw something out the window anywhere, you'd hit a fundamentalist, indicating that's how popular Bible-believing Christians were in America. And they dominated the culture in the 19th century. For example, chapel attendance was required in most universities.
Oh, really?
As a matter of fact, I was recently, in the last week, dabbling in the biography of R.A. Torrey. Remember who R.A. Torrey was, the successor of D.L. Moody? He attended Yale, was not a believer as he entered Yale. His mother and was a very committed Christian, praying for him. He got converted before he left Yale. But in the biography, it talks about the fact that he hated the Bible and he hated going to chapel. Yale had chapel, and it was required. All right. Evangelical piety was expected in the White House. Fundamentalism was described as, quote, the largest, most written about, most widespread religious doctrine in America. So it permeated the culture. Now, there's no internet, radio, TV, newspapers, yes, but it was the dominant culture. No, there were no movies. All right? Until about this time. In 1926, a reporter said, oh, here's the story. Heave an egg out of a Pullman window and you will hit a fundamentalist almost anywhere in America today. That's the story. It's in my notes. I'd forgotten it was here. But that's how prevalent and predominant Christianity was in the United States. But within the span of one generation, between 1890 and 1930, the extraordinary influence of evangelicalism in the public sphere of Christian culture collapsed.
Oh.
Few respected educational institutions of any sort in northern United States would tolerate fundamentalist teaching. The Scopes trial in 1925 is often viewed by historians as the time when fundamentalism began to drift into decline and become a subculture. Now, think about this. In the 19th century, it's the dominant culture. And by 25 is not a bad date, but certainly by 1930, it's a subculture.
Oh, my goodness.
And the fundamentalists have retreated. They've separated. Fundamentalism came to be identified with anti-scholarly, anti-intellectual, anti-cultural attitude. So, you got to get the picture. Liberalism, who reacted to that? The fundamentalist. Now, we're going to have a reaction among Christians to the fundamentalist. And they are called neo-evangelical. Neo-evangelical is a reaction to the development within fundamentalism. Theologically conservatives broke away from fundamentalists to re-enter American culture and intellectual life. At first, they were called neo-evangelicals, but eventually, neo dropped off, and now the popular word would just be, I'm an evangelical, rather than, I'm a fundamentalist. Now, That's sort of the background. What I'm going to do next is tell you how all this began. But I want to tell you it has to do, in large part, with Fuller Seminary. A number of years ago, the president of Fuller Seminary invited a professor named Marsden to write the history of Fuller Seminary. They turned over to him all of the archives and said to him, tell the story and don't hold anything back. Just tell it like it happened. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book. It's a very scholarly book, and it's called Reforming Fundamentalism. Fuller's intent was to reform fundamentalism. Now, the material I'm about to go over is virtually all from Marsden. So I want you to know that I'm not picking on Fuller. I'm trying to be objective and just say, here is what the official biography and institution, the official history of Fuller says, and it's the sanctioned history of the institution at the time it was written. All right, so here we go. The exact date of the beginning of neo-evangelicalism is difficult to determine. Historians have traced the beginning to the formation of the National Council of Evangelicals. You heard of that organization? It was founded in 1942. Harold Ockingay was one of the founders. Now, Ockingay, by the way, is spelled O-C-K-E-N-G-A. O-C-K-E-N-G-A. He's a very important figure at this point. So he was one of the founders. We're going to form the National Association of Evangelicals. Not neo-evangelicals, not fundamentalists, just evangelicals. Some of the most committed fundamentalists in the country, staunch fundamentalists, like Bob Jones, the founder of Bob Jones University, and John R. Rice, the editor of The Sword of the Lord, joined the National Association of Evangelicals. So at this point, there was another organization that was even to the right of them. It was called the American Council of Christian Churches, and it was started by Carl McIntyre in 1941. But these fundamentalists didn't join that one. He was really militant. I remember hearing him on the radio. Of course, he's dead now. But at this point, and this is important, the word fundamentalist and evangelical are synonyms.
Oh.
And 1942. So they didn't name it the National Association of Fundamentalists. They named it the National Association of Evangelicals, but the fundamentalists were in it. I mean, they were, even some of the militant fundamentalists were in it. So, this is the beginning. Ockingay used the term new evangelicalism in connection with Fuller Seminary, and he popularized it in 1957. According to Marsden, the early Fuller, the beginning of Fuller, was, quote, a fundamentalist institution with thoroughly fundamentalist constituents. The men involved in the founding of Fuller did not intend to break away from fundamentalism. Rather, they intended to reform it from within. And what they didn't like was the separation from the denominations and the anti-intellectual attitude and reputation that fundamentalism has gained. So Marsden's theory of Fuller Seminary is entitled Reforming Fundamentalism. Thus, Fuller provided a leading role in New Evangelicals' attempt to reform fundamentalism. So, I'm going to talk about this in various stages. So the first thing we need to talk about is dissatisfaction. The neo-evangelicals were dissatisfied, that's a key word, with fundamentalism. In his book, Neo-Evangelicalism, Bob Leitner, who was, I would say, probably closer to a militant fundamentalist, I knew him personally, describes the dissatisfaction. So, Harold Ockingay, the first president of Fuller Seminary, was displeased with fundamentalism because of its wrong attitude, wrong strategy, and wrong results. Its wrong attitude was the unwarranted suspicion of everybody. Its wrong strategy was assuming that a pure church is possible, and its wrong result is that it lost every ecclesiastical battle. That was Harold Ockingay's opinion. Carl Henry. How many of you have heard of Carl Henry? When I was in college and took a course in philosophy, he wrote the textbook. Very brilliant guy. He was a professor at Fuller Seminary, and he was dissatisfied with fundamentalism because it had too little concern for the whole counsel of God, lacked dedication to producing scholarly books, relying instead on reprints of theological classics, too much criticism of denominations, and too much identification with dispensational premillennialism, and having a bankrupt spirit, a harsh temperament, a loveless spirit, and nevertheless a spirit of an unnecessary spirit of strife. It was no longer a theological position, but rather a mood and a disposition. And you know what? Having been on the inside of that movement in the 50s and 60s, I was a student in a school that was associated with that. He's right. That now, the people involved were very evangelistic. I mean, they wanted to win the world to Christ, but it was an attitude, and it was, they separated, they were battle scarred, and it was a mood, and it was, I'm talking about fundamentalism, and it was a disposition. I think he's right. Edward Carnell, a professor and later president at Fuller, was disgruntled with fundamentalism because it had become mentally not a movement. It was too rigid and too closely associated with dispensationalism, with its intellectual stagnation. It was more concerned with the salvation of souls. Remember, I told you it was evangelistic, rather than social impact. And it had a negative attitude, especially in the area of a separated life and social norms, meaning you can't go to movies and you can't play cards and smoke and dance and chew or go with girls that do. All right, that's the dissatisfaction. Now, the next thing I want to do is to discuss the definition. So what is evangelicalism, neo-evangelicalism? Ockingay, the man who coined the term, explains the essence of neo-evangelicalism is a news release in 1957. Now, I'm going to read the news release to you. You ready for this? Sit back and enjoy. He says, the new evangelicalism is the latest dress of orthodoxy, as neo-orthodoxy is the latest expression of theological liberalism. The new evangelicalism differs from fundamentalism in its willingness to handle the social problems which fundamentalism evaded. There is need to be no dichotomy between the personal gospel and the social gospel. The true Christian faith is a supernatural personal experience of salvation and a social philosophy. Doctrine and social ethics are Christian disciplines. Fundamentalism abducted leadership and responsibility in the social realm and thus became impotent to change society and to solve social problems. The new evangelicalism adheres to all the orthodox teachings of fundamentalism, but has evolved to, but includes and has evolved a social philosophy. What a statement. We're going to hold to the fundamentalist doctrines, but remember now, the fundamentalists were separating and fighting. Mm-hmm. We're going to stop that nonsense. I'm paraphrasing. And we're going to go reform society. Interesting. Back to the news release. The new evangelicalism has changed its strategy from one of separation to one of infiltration. Instead of static front battles, the new theological war is one of movement. Instead of attack upon error, the new evangelicals proclaim the great historic doctrines of Christianity. The result has been phenomenal. The new evangelical is willing to face the intellectual problems and meet the in the framework of modern learning. It stands doctrinally upon the creeds and confessions of the church and grants liberty in minor areas where discussion is promoted on the basis of the exegesis of Scripture. The strategy of the new evangelicals is the positive proclamation of the truth in distinction from all error without delving into personalities, which embraces the error. The evangelical believes that Christianity is intellectually defensible, but that Christians cannot be obscurist in scientific questions pertaining to the creation, the age of man, the universality of the flood, and other moot biblical questions. The evangelical attempts to apply the Christian faith to every area of every phase of life. So, we need to be honest scientifically about things like the flood. Was it universal? No? Okay. More about the news release. Quote, "Since I first coined the phrase, the new evangelicalism, at a convention address at Fuller Theological Seminary 10 years ago, the evangelical forces have been welded into an organizational front. First, there is the National Association of Evangelicals, which provides articulation for the movement on the denominational level. Second, there is the World Evangelical Fellowship, which binds together those individual national associations of some 26 countries and a world organization. Third, there is the new apologetic literature stating this point of view, which now flows from the presses of the great publishers, including Macmillan and Harper's. Fourth, there is the existence of Fuller Theological Seminary and other evangelical seminaries which are fully committed to Orthodox Christianity and a resultant social philosophy. Fifth, there is the establishment of Christianity Today." Have you ever heard of Christianity Today?
Yes.
Wait, yeah. It's the website,
the,
yeah.
It's the foremost Christian magazine. There's more about that coming, but he's at this point just saying in the news release, we've got Fuller Seminary and Christianity Today, and, you know, we're a whole new breed. A biweekly publication to articulate the convictions of the movement. Sixth, there is an appearance of an evangelist, Billy Graham, who, on the mass level, is the spokesman of the convictions and ideals of the new evangelicalism. The strength of this movement is recognized by Christian Century. Pause. Christian Century is the mouthpiece for liberalism.
Oh.
Christian Century is synonymous with liberal theology. So, he is saying that the strength of the movement is recognized by Christian Century. Wow. The liberals are recognizing we're coming. America's leading theological liberal magazine. That's his definition of Christian Century. And by its expression of fear that the movement may challenge the religious scene and change the religious climate in the nation. The new evangelicals believe that Christ is the answer, that he must be understood in a biblical framework, and that he is in his teachings must be applied to every realm of social existence or societal existence. End of quote. Now, that's as good as it gets.
I can't do a better job than the founder and one that invented the word. But here's my attempt. In other words, neo-evangelicalism held to the fundamentals of the faith, but not to the negative attitude, dispensationalism, denominational separation, intellectual stagnation of fundamentalism. It was committed to a positive proclamation, denominational infiltration instead of separation, a scholarly approach, taking scientific questions such as creation, the age of man, and the flood seriously, and social involvement. That summarizes neo-evangelicalism. All right? Now, in the meantime, there is an institution in Dallas called Dallas Seminary, and it has a president at the time named John Walford. He became the president in 1952. And he described new evangelicalism like this. And there is a small denomination called the Independent Fundamental Churches of America, the IFCA. John MacArthur is a member of that group. John Walford was a member of that group. So he's more identified with the fundamentalists, although Dallas didn't get involved in all of this. At any rate, he put the neo-evangelicals like this, quote, "It claimed that the same theology as old fundamentalism, but was an attempt to redeem its deficiencies. It first of all was opposed to separationism. The neo-evangelicals felt free to work in most Protestant denominations and do not believe in separation from them unless forced to leave. New evangelicalism countered the oft-repeated charge of anti-intellectualism leveled at fundamentalism by an emphasis on scholarship and intellectualism in an endeavor to meet modernism on its own level scholarly. As against the charge of being antisocial and indifferent to contemporary issues which are often laid at the door of fundamentalism, new evangelicalism emphasizes participation and taking a stand on social and moral issues as a necessary adjunct of neo-evangelical Christianity. New evangelicalism also tends to evade some of the criticisms leveled at fundamentalism by becoming one of its critics. By some new evangelicals, the most extreme kind of fundamentalist controversy was pictured as the norm. New evangelicalism was loud in its denial of fundamentalist controversy and at the same time praised liberal theologians for their scholarship, cogency, and relevance. Strenuous efforts were made to attract the liberals and encourage them to listen to the neo-evangelical position." That was Walford. Now, the reason I quote that is he and Achengay are saying the same thing. That's a good assessment. I'm just trying to give one from inside and one from outside. And they're both basically saying the same thing. Rather, I could quote other people that would just agree. That's the essence of neo-evangelicalism. It's a reaction to fundamentalism, like fundamentalism was a reaction to liberalism. So what I want you to see in the drift of history is that reaction. All right. Since Fuller Seminary is at the heart and core of new evangelicalism, we got to talk about Fuller Seminary. So we're going to talk about the founders. Since new evangelicalism is closely related to Fuller Seminary, to understand new evangelicalism, it's necessary to understand the founding and some of the history of Fuller Seminary. Now, in 1947, Charles E. Fuller and others founded the seminary in Pasadena. And the founders and first faculty members were fundamentalists. How many of you know who Charles Fuller was?
I heard a lot of that.
I heard a little bit, yeah.
All right. Back when Charles Fuller had a radio broadcast, the old-fashioned Revival Hour, I think was the name of it. I think we'll get to that. Nationally, he was the voice.
Fundamentalist.
Oh, yeah. He preached the gospel. Matter of fact, he held I think in an auditorium down in Long Beach every Sunday afternoon. It was broadcast live. I knew a man. I met him in the 70s and knew him through the 80s, who used to go down there when Fuller was alive and sing in the choir. But it was the voice of Christianity in America because of the radio broadcast. Yeah, yeah. So he decided to help found Fuller Seminary. All right, but the founders of Fuller Seminary were fundamentalists.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about them.
That's weird.
Most of them had been influenced by J. Gretchen Machen. Remember him? He was the Presbyterian that was at Princeton, and broke away and founded Westminster. Mm-hmm. Remember that? So these men that I'm going to talk about went to, in Harold Lockengate's case, he went to Westminster. But so they were influenced by Machen, who was really the intellectual giant among fundamentalists. So the Baptists got down in the trenches and did all the fighting. Machen did some of his own fighting. He separated from Presbyterians, but he was much more of an intellectual than the rest of them. The rest of them were evangelists out there winning people to Christ, and Machen was writing books. All right. Besides Charles Fuller, the founder was Harold Ockengate, the first president. The charter faculty members were Carl Henry, Wilbur M. Smith, Everett Harrison, and Harold Lenzel. Now, Wilbur Smith had written a lot of books and was known as a Bible teacher. Everett Harrison was teaching at Dallas Seminary and left Dallas to come to Fuller. All right, so let's talk about some of these men. Fuller graduated from Pomona College, right down the street, in 1910. Studied at the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, now Biola University, and later became the chairman of the board of Biola. Whoa. From 1928 to 1932, he was a Presbyterian who became a Baptist. He was the speaker of the Old Fashioned Revival Hour, a weekly Sunday broadcast from 1937 to 1968. That is a long tenure. He was a dispensationalist, having learned it from R.A. Torrey, who was the pastor of the Church of the Open Door, and I think president of Biola. So here's Fuller, who was a student and comrade with R.A. Torrey. Fuller sent out dispensational charts to listeners of his radio broadcast. In 1946, when he was planning the school, he wrote to Lewis Berry Chafer, the founder of Dallas Seminary, for suggestions for a young man, preferably a graduate of Dallas, to help lead the new institution. He added that his son Dan was considering going to Dallas. Instead of going to Dallas, he went to Princeton, partly because of it was prestige and partly because Ralph Winter, his best friend from high school and Lake Avenue Church, was going there. All right, that's Fuller. Harold Ockengate studied under Machen at Princeton and was deeply influenced by him. Although Ockengate had been a Methodist, he adopted Machen's Presbyterian theology. He even followed Machen to Westminster, later earned a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Pittsburgh. He agreed to serve as president of Fuller in absentia to recruit the faculty. He was a pastor in Boston, but he became the first president to help assemble the faculty and in absentia, meaning from a long way away. Carl Henry began as a journalist. He attended Wheaton College, where he got a bachelor's and a master's. He was influenced by Gordon Clark, who was devoted to Machen. He earned doctorates at Northern Baptist Theological Seminary. He was an American Baptist, got a Ph.D. Boston University, where he got a Ph.D. And in 1947, he wrote the book, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, in which he rejected liberalism and held to the fundamentals of the faith, but rejected the rigid and disengagement of fundamentalism. In 1956, at the urging of Billy Graham, he became the first editor of Christianity Today. Mm-hmm. And he remained the editor until 1968. Then there was Wilbur Smith. He came from a family connected with fundamentalism. His father was converted under the ministry of D.L. Moody, and his mother was the assistant to R.A. Torrey, of all things. He never earned a degree, not even a high school diploma. Before finishing high school, he entered Moody Bible Institute. Then he transferred to college, but before he finished, he became a pastor of a Presbyterian church. Nevertheless, he was an ardent, dispensational premillennialist. Okay. The founding faculty of Fuller.
Imagine.
All right? Who recommended his students to the Evangelical Theological College in Dallas, later became known as Dallas Theological Seminary. So he was a dispensational premillennialist and telling people to go to Dallas Seminary. In 1932, the Evangelical Theological College, that was the original name of Dallas, it changed its name to Dallas Seminary, gave him the doctorate of divinity degree. He was immersed and admired Machen. So all of these founding faculty members were really committed to Machen, or influenced by Machen. When Smith told Achengay that he did not have a single earned degree, Achengay told Smith that at Fuller he wanted practical application of Christianity. The idea is to train young men to be able preachers of the Word of God, to lead people to Christ. You are better able to be a model of such a new breed of preachers and inspire them, he told Smith. Smith left Moody Bible Institute. He thought it lacked vision and joined Fuller. Then we have Everett Harrison, who earned a degree at Princeton and where he studied under Machen. He got a doctorate degree at Dallas in 1938. And a Ph.D. at the University, he got a doctorate of theology at Dallas. Then he got a Ph.D. at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as a missionary in China. Thought you'd appreciate that. As a Presbyterian pastor and as a Presbyterian pastor in Pennsylvania. He taught at both Dallas Seminary and Fuller Seminary. He was competent in Greek, Hebrew, Armenian, German, Latin, and French. You just shake your head at that. All right. Then there's Harold Lindzell. Obtained a degree from Wheaton College, where he was influenced by Clark, who was a devoted follower of Machen. Then he attended the University of California at Berkeley and got a Ph.D. at New York University. He taught at Columbia Bible College, Northern Baptist Theological Seminary, the American Baptist School near Chicago, and at Fuller Seminary. He served as editor of Christianity Today and was president of the Evangelical Theological Society, and he wrote the book, The Battle for the Bible. That becomes the issue. We will get to that in a minute. So, the faculty at Fuller consisted of scholarly fundamentalists, both dispensationalists and non-dispensationalists. Now, you've got to appreciate what's about to happen. You've got to understand that here is Charles Fuller, the Billy Graham, before Billy Graham, and a staunch dispensational premillennialist. And some of these men, I read to you their pedigrees, and that was the founding of Fuller Seminary. They were committed to fundamentalism, but they wanted to reform it. Mm-hmm. All right. Where are we? I told you he wrote the book, The Battle for the Bible. The faculty at Fuller consisted of scholarly fundamentalism. I told you that. In the words of Marsden, they were conservative Republicans and respectable fundamentalists. Lenzel, one of the four founding faculty members of Fuller and member of Fuller, said Fuller Theological Seminary, quote, was created for the express purpose of developing an apologetic for biblical inerrancy. Now, remember what I told you was the definition of a fundamentalist? It goes back to B.B. Warfield and A.A. Hodge, who wrote an article on inerrancy, and Briggs reacted to that, which was sort of the seed of the whole liberal fundamentalist controversy. So no less than Harold Lenzel says that's why Fuller Seminary was founded, to defend inerrancy. Interesting. Along came a new tide of literate, scholarly, mentally competent of the old Princeton school of Hodge, Warfield, Green, and Machen. There was a moment, a time, when Princeton Seminary had intellectual giants committed to the scripture. And that's B.B. Warfield and Machen and those guys. And the guys that founded Fuller were fundamentalists who had been influenced by that kind of intellectual strain of Christianity. The founders and the first faculty members of the Fuller Seminary were fundamentalists, but they were moderate fundamentalists. Now, remember the threefold division of fundamentalism? The militant, the moderate, and the modified? Important. They were moderate. But remember when we talked about that, Dollar said Fuller was the modified. They started out moderate, and they became modified. And that's the story of neo-evangelicalism. They were moderate fundamentalism is that they were not bent on ecclesiastical separation. Early in his life, Fuller led a Sunday school class at a Presbyterian church to reorganize as the Calvary Church of Placentia. Now it's called the Calvary Church of Berea. Having separated from Presbyterianism, he was ordained by the Baptist Bible Union, an organization of dispensational fundamental Baptists who had separated separatist tendencies. But as a board member of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, he went through an experience of dismissing a faculty member and as a result moved toward the side of fundamentalism that stressed a positive message rather than controversy. All right. When Machen left Princeton Seminary to form Westminster Seminary, Harold Ockingay left Princeton as a student and went with Machen. But when Machen organized the Independent Board of Presbyterian Foreign Missions in direct competition with the denominations board, although Ockingay was sympathetic, he did not break with the denominational board. In 1943, when about 300 churches and the Denver Conservative Baptist Seminary separated from the Northern Baptist, modern-day American Baptist, Carl Henry, who was teaching at Northern Baptist Seminary, the American Baptist Seminary, regarded such separation as premature and stayed with the Northern Baptist. At the time, he estimated that 85% of the convention were evangelicals. In other words, he's saying 85% of American Baptists, what are now American Baptists, were evangelical, fundamentalists, if you will. Wilbur Smith sided with Machen and even accepted a position on the executive committee of the independent board. So did Charles Woodbridge. Now, he was not a founding faculty member, but he came later, who was later joined the faculty at Fuller. But eventually, evidently, he strongly opposed Machen's separatist course and, under pressure from the denominations, resigned from the independent board. Charles Woodbridge. What I'm trying to say is all these founders and early leaders of Fuller had, prior to Fuller, resisted separating from the denominations. That's the key word, because the fundamentalists were separating in the 30s. Now we're in the 40s, and we've assembled a group of men who are just as staunchly fundamental as the fundamentalist, but they didn't want to separate from the denominations. Everett Harrison had impeccable fundamentalist credentials when he became pastor of a Presbyterian church that had experienced a split over fundamentalism. He remained loyal to the denomination. That experience gave him a taste of the resentment generated by the separatists. Along with Carl Henry, Harold Ockengay, who was teaching at Northern Seminary, they rejected separationism. All of these men were fundamentalists, but they were not separatists. Marsden points out, quote, "Some of the most ardent fundamentalists, such as William B. Riley, the Pope of Minnesota Baptist fundamentalism, was not separatist, or were not separatist," which is a kind of a startling statement. If you know, remember, W.B. Riley was one of the great leaders of the fundamentalist movement. The early founders of Fuller wanted to establish a scholarly institution. From the very beginning, Charles Fuller wanted Fuller Seminary to be absolutely true to the fundamentals and at the same time be a school of high scholarship. Those influenced by Machen were of the same opinion. Machen and his followers were convinced that scholarship as well as piety were, quote, absolutely necessary for the establishment of a solid foundation of long-term evangelicalism, survival, and resurgence. End of quote. In February 1947, Fuller met Ockengay, who felt scholarship was pivotal to the success of the whole evangelical movement. Thus, Fuller's practical vision, combined with Ockengay's strategic enterprise, formed Fuller Seminary. Carl Henry and Harold Linzel attended Wheaton College, where they were influenced by Gordon Clark, who was devoted to Machen. Fuller's first news release described the seminary as, quote, "a research institution for evangelical scholarship," end of quote. And Fuller said he wanted a seminary to be the Caltech of the evangelical world. Now that gives you, that really says what they're about. We want to be like MIT and Caltech, scholarly, but we're committed to the fundamentals of the faith. And nobody questioned that. They just questioned, the fundamentalists questioned their separation, their lack of separation. The early founders of Fuller Seminary wanted a social emphasis. They considered the opening of the seminary to be the beginning of a new age of evangelicals. Ockengay delivered the convocation address in which he declared that the mission of the seminary was not just in training pastors and missionaries, but to be involved in the task of saving Western civilization. Marsden says this was a repudiation of the dispensational view that the church was, quote, "a refuge in a ruined culture," end of quote, and an affirmation of the Calvinist Puritan view that the church was to play a central role in civilization building. Now, this is really kind of interesting. It's a very astute little point that the early dispensationalists were really caught up with the Lord's coming back, and we're headed toward a tribulation. Now, they were pre-trib, so they didn't think they were going to go through it. But the idea was that those the dispensationists, and remember now, that's not synonymous with fundamentalism, but the dispensationalists identified with it, and so fundamentalism. So it they became almost intertwined, at least in the Baptist world, but not in the Presbyterian world, because they were Calvinistic and covenant theology. They weren't dispensational. But what I want you to understand is that the dispensationalists were thinking, man, we're on a sinking ship. We're on the Titanic, and it's going down, so get as many people saved as you can. The Lord's coming back any minute. And the Calvinists were, well, you know, the Lord put us here to change society. So that's the what's going on here. So the founders of Fuller were saying, no, we're going to repudiate the attitude, at least, of dispensationalism. We want to, and even the dispensationalists on the faculty wanted to infiltrate the denominations, not separate from them. Akinjay announced the seminary would be ecclesiastically positive. He said, we do not believe and we repudiate the come-out-ism, meaning coming out of denominations. Marsden said this was a direct attack on Carl McIntyre, who insisted that separation was basic to fundamentalism. Remember, Carl McIntyre's the Presbyterian, who's a real fighter. Man, he was the Donald Trump of his day. I heard him preach. McIntyre responded by having the American Council of Christian Churches pass a resolution condemning Akinjay's address and Fuller Seminary for violating the command of Scripture to separate from apostasy. Marsden observes, a pattern was now set that would continue through Fuller Seminary's first several decades. The school would aspire to be a force for renewal and broadening of fundamentalism and evangelicalism. Wilbur Smith, a dispensationalist, viewed civilization as beyond repair. That's the dispensational attitude. And that Christians were to preach the gospel, keep themselves pure, and wait for the Lord's return. While remaining premillennial, Harold Akinjay and Carl Henry abandoned dispensational preoccupation with the signs of the time as signs of the end and adopted a view of history more characteristic of Reformed theology, meaning that Christians have the task of reforming culture to bring it more conformity to God's law and will. They felt fundamentalists were too preoccupied with personal and ecclesiastical separation, that they had no social impact. Henry cited the controversy at Wheaton College concerning whether or not the game of Rook. Do you know what the card game of Rook is? It's a card game, but it doesn't have all the cards of the traditional card deck. So there's this great debate at Wheaton. You understand what Wheaton College is? It's the citadel of grandfather of Christian institutions. You know, it's been there forever. A lot of Christian leaders have gone through it. Billy Graham graduated from Wheaton College. A lot of missionaries have graduated from Wheaton College. Well, back in that day, they were debating whether or not Rook fell under the prohibition of card games. Fundamentalist concerns for smoking and mixed swimming. Do you know about that? Boys and girls can't swim together. They called it mixed swimming. I got saved in a Baptist church in Florida in 1958 where they thought mixed swimming was a sin. All right.
That's why I'm not a fundamentalist. I haven't known that. Actually, I was raised
in a fundamentalist. Yeah, right.
Oh my goodness.
The ladies, they cannot wear high heel, or you cannot show the skin.
Right.
Of the ladies. Right. They're gonna be kicked out of the church.
Right.
It's very strict.
This is exactly what happened in Thailand. On the Sunday worship service, they cannot wear anything short. My wife, they told my wife, you know, the dressing code.
It's worldly.
Yeah. They, you know, we have the dressing code on Sunday.
All right, now that was part and parcel of fundamentalism. So this neo-evangelicalism is dumping that and You know.
I remember that before they have worship, sister on one side and brother on
that's
the
right.
other side.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Wow. That's right.
China. Has it done China?
Yeah, it's happened in China.
All right. So back to Wilbur Smith. We got to wait for the Lord's return. While remaining premillennial, let's go back. Harold Ockingay and Carl Henry abandoned the preoccupation of these are the signs of the end and so forth. They felt fundamentalism was too preoccupied, as I said a minute ago, with ecclesiastical separation and personal separation, that they had no social impact. So he cited this controversy about the card game. He also noticed the inconsistency among Northern and Southern fundamentalists concerning smoking and mixed swimming. Yet after leading a young man to Christ on an airplane, Carl Henry convinced the fellow to give up his pack of cigarettes and deck of cards. I think that's one of the most hilarious stories I've found in all of church history. Carl Henry, the highly educated, highly sophisticated leader of the neo-evangelicalism, led a man to Christ and asked for his cigarettes and deck of cards. By social involvement, Ockingay and Henry meant opposition to aggressive warfare, racial hatred, intolerance, the liquor traffic, and exploitation of labor or management. Ockingay and Henry were not calling for the social gospel to replace evangelism. Personal salvation was a priority, but Christians also had the task of transforming society. Actually, they had rejected the dispensational view of the kingdom then, as well as the liberal view of the kingdom now. In their opinion, the kingdom was partly realized now and would be completely realized when Christ returned. The kingdom work today included not only preaching salvation, but also exercising compassion in anticipation of the coming rule of Christ. Now, this is really getting at the difference between fundamentalism and neo-evangelicalism. The reformers of fundamentalism at Fuller remained faithful to what had been the central thrust of American evangelicalism, at least since the days of D.L. Moody. While their agenda had expanded to include rehabilitation of scholarship and social consequences, evangelism remained absolutely necessary. So, with money from his father's foundation, I heard it was $10 million.
Back then, oh my goodness.
That was a lot of money. And his own national radio broadcast, Fuller purchased a mansion in Pasadena and announced the opening of Fuller Seminary, which I think is named after his father, not him, on his radio broadcast in December 1947. Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ, who entered Princeton Seminary the previous year, and 38 others made up the first class of Fuller Seminary. Bill Bright. All right. So what I've done is introduce to you the movement, and I've talked about the founders. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about are the difficult days at Fuller. All right. Difficult days are coming. One of Fuller's aims was to regain influence in the mainline Protestant denominations. That proved to be easier said than done. Machen tells the story in great detail. In the fall of 1947, the Los Angeles Presbytery began taking steps to remove Harold Ockingay from the Presbyterian ministry if he continued with Fuller. That failed. Carl Henry was cut out of his retirement program of the Northern Baptist when he went to Fuller. in the bold move to get the Los Angeles Presbytery to accept Fuller, Fuller Seminary hired Bella Vasady. It's V-A-S-A-D-Y, a highly regarded Hungarian Reformed theologian. He was an admirer of Karl Barth. Who's Karl Barth? Where does he fit in all of this?
Neo-Orthodoxy.
Yeah. So Fuller has now, in their early days, hired a Neo-Orthodox, or somebody that admired it. He was one of the founders of the World Council of Churches, an organization fundamentalists thought was liberal. He was definitely an evangelical at heart. That did not work either. The Los Angeles Presbytery refused his membership. That was bad enough, but more trouble erupted when he wrote an article in which he lavishly praised ecumenicalism. Carl McIntyre pounced on that and on Fuller for allowing it. Another fierce fundamentalist who was a member of the Conservative Baptist Fellowship, a group that had broken away from the Northern Baptist Fellowship, American Baptist, got upset with this guy's praise of ecumenicalism, and he used and his use of neo-Orthodox language in his speech. Letters of complaint poured into the seminary. Some of at Fuller feared the loss of potential conservative Baptists. The seminary drew up a statement on inerrancy, and this fella refused to sign it. So when his contract was up, he left. Now, I said those are difficult days. From there, Fuller started to drift away from fundamentalism. At the beginning, Fuller's aim was to reform fundamentalism. But in the opinion of fundamentalists, Fuller began to drift from fundamentalism. Many fundamentalists would say the drift began when they had hired the guy that I just mentioned. Another issue that greatly upset the fundamentalists was Fuller's handling of the Revised Standard Version published by the National Council of Churches. Y'all know about the RSV? You never heard? You see, back in those days, there was only the King James Version, and back at the turn of the century, the American Standard, and then the Revised Standard. Well, the Revised Standard, Isaiah 7:14, you know, the verse that says that the Messiah is going to be born of a virgin, they translated that young women. So no fundamentalist would touch that Bible. They claimed it denied the virgin birth. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you were a young woman in Isaiah's day, you were a virgin. But that didn't satisfy them. The release of the RSV, New Testament, in 1946 was a problem for fundamentalists. John R. Rice, a staunch fundamentalist, who was the editor of The Sword of the Lord, I heard him preach many times, allowed his name to be used in the advertisement for it. That's shocking. The release of the Revised Standard Old Testament was another issue. In Isaiah 7:14, instead of the virgin shall conceive, it read a young woman shall conceive. Rice retracted his endorsement. McIntyre held back to the Bible meetings across the country. He reported that some pastors publicly burned the blasphemous translation. Whether or not one accepted the RSV immediately became the symbol of loyalty to either fundamentalism or the ecumenical movement. Although mildly divided on the merits of the RSV, the faculty Fuller defended it. William Lesore argued that young woman was an appropriate translation of Isaiah 7:14. The faculty even conducted a public debate on the RSV at Lake Avenue Congregational Church in Pasadena. Carnell and Lesore were for it. Archer and Lazell argued against it. Yet the faculty basically stood together on the issue. Archer, Harrison, Woodbridge, Lesore planned to write a book with the balanced view on the subject. But balance was not the road to popularity. The old-fashioned revival hour, this national broadcast by Charles Fuller, began losing contributions by the bushel. Fuller assured his subscribers that while he rejected the RSV, the seminary professors ought to be free to examine it. Such distinctions were lost on fundamentalists. One member of the old-fashioned Revival Hour board resigned. Fuller lost 100,000 radio subscribers.
Wow. That's it.
He called for a moratorium on the public discussion of the RSV. Until that issue arose, Carnell thought of himself as a great champion of orthodoxy. But because of this issue, he began to think he needed to purge himself from the fundamentalist illness. He concluded, quote, "Jesus names love, not defense of doctrine, as the sign of true discipleship," end of quote. This became a turning point for him personally and would soon put the seminary on a new course. Carnell became the president of Fuller Seminary. So now we're going to talk about its departure. Fuller's real departure from fundamentalism took place during the presidency of Carnell. Edward John Carnell graduated from Wheaton College, where he majored in philosophy under the Calvinistic philosopher Gordon Clark, who was influenced by Machen. Carnell also graduated from Westminster Theological Seminary with a Bachelor of Theology and a Master's of Theology, Harvard with a Ph.D., and Boston University with a Ph.D. After serving for 3 years on the faculty of Gordon College, a very Baptist, fundamentalist kind of school, and Divinity School, he became professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in 1948, where he taught until his death until 1967. He served as the second president. In his inaugural address, he said the crowning glory of the seminary would be the spirit of tolerance. We're going to tolerate. Now, remember when we discussed fundamentalism, what Dollar said was the key to an institution drifting from fundamentalism into liberalism, meaning Harvard, Yale, and Princeton? Tolerance. We're fundamentalists, but we will tolerate. This is in his inaugural address. To fundamentalists, talk of love and tolerance smacked of liberalism. To them, when Christian leaders started talking about love, heresy would not be far behind. Wilmer Smith was unhappy about Carnell's appointment as president. Now he was fuming. Woodbridge was appalled that Achingay did not demand a retraction or a resignation. Smith, Woodbridge, Henry, and Lenzel confronted Carnell, assuring him that he did not speak for them. LeSueur and Ladd stood up for Carnell. For the first time, the faculty was divided, not so much by doctrine as by attitude. Now, I have to tell you that I became a Christian in 1958, was immediately shipped off to a moderately fundamentalist school called Tennessee Temple University in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was called college at that point. Came university later. And one of the speakers was Charles Woodbridge. I knew nothing about Christianity. Nothing. And Charles Woodbridge was very, very concerned about Fuller. And so he came as a Bible teacher and made a great impression on me in that case. And we had a special side meeting. It wasn't part of the conference, but this afternoon, if you're interested, I'll share with you. And I remember in very veiled terms, he spoke about the drift and Jesuit casuistry. He was concerned that Christians were going to adopt Jesuit casuistry, which is the end justifies the means. He did not name anybody, but to those who knew where he was from, they understood. I didn't at the time, and if you'd have told me Fuller, that would have meant nothing to me. But I heard Woodbridge talk about this. All right. In a step away from the fundamentalist orbit, Carnell made league with people like Ladd and Dan Fuller. Have you ever heard of Dan Fuller? No?
Be the son.
Be the son. To get the statement about premillennialism removed from the seminary statement of faith. Cornell argued that neither Calvin, Warfield, Hodge, nor Machen would have taught at Fuller Seminary because in the statement it said premillennialism, and they were all amillennialists, and they were all influenced by, either directly or indirectly, Machen. Charles Fuller objected. He was a dispensational premillennialist, but signed the statement that after his death, the premillennial clause could be removed. It's called tolerance.
Tolerance.
By the way, Charles Fuller, Smith, Woodbridge, Henry, LaSalle, and Harrison were pre-trib. Cornell, Ladd, Romney, Dan Fuller were post-trib. Enter Billy Graham. Billy was a factor in the development of neo-evangelicalism. In 1951, Wilbur Smith outlined his dream to Billy for the need of a monthly Christian publication, periodical. What he had in mind was a magazine devoted to biblical exposition and prophecy with religious news and reviews of important books, but, quote, no attention to trash, close quote. In 1954, Graham became convinced that such a substantial theological voice would be an important follow-up to his crusades. When Linzel suggested Carl Henry to be an excellent editor, Graham said, in effect, Henry might be too much of a fundamentalist. He's the guy that asked for the cigarettes and the deck of cards. Wow. Graham envisioned a periodical that would, quote, plant the evangelical flag in the middle of the road, taking a conservative theological position, but definitely liberal approach to social problems. It would combine the best of liberalism and the best of fundamentalism without compromising theologically. Graham added, quote, its view of inspiration would be somewhat along the lines of the recent book by Bernard Rann when I was a student at Dallas Seminary. Took a course in hermeneutics. That book was our textbook. Bertrand Rann was a professor at American Baptist Seminary that was in Los Angeles that's now defunct. But the professors at Dallas thought that book was okay, and Graham said, we'll use that as the touchstone for whether or not you believe in inspiration. He was referring to Rand's book, The Christian View of Science and Scripture, in which he suggested a view that inspiration would allow for a divinely guided development of the species. Rand's book, I think one of his other books was our book on our textbook, not that one. Ram's book caused the greatest stir in fundamentalism since the RSV controversy. At any rate, Christianity was born in 1956. Carl Henry was its first editor. Ockenguy was chairman of the board. By the way, Carl Henry became the first editor, even though he was too fundamentalist. All right. In 1954, during his campaign in England, Graham received a broad church support than his fundamentalist supporters in America would have allowed him. That led him to the conviction that he could make inroads into America's major denominations if he could only jettison the fundamentalist image of separation and anti-intellectualism and contentionism. End of quote. He did not want to tie his ministry to a narrow view of the implications of the inerrancy of Scripture for modern science. There's our issue again, inerrancy. He, by the way, in his early days, he was a Scofield-carrying Christian. He would not identify evangelical Christianity with the most conservative politics. He recently, his recent stand for racial integration of his crusade exemplified this point. Nor would he totally condemn the ecumenical movement. By the way, I grew up in Florida, the Panhandle, which is South Alabama. Graham made a major social impact by not allowing his crusades to be segregated. When he allowed the blacks to come, that was a major move. So we are changing culture. And Graham did it more than anybody at Fuller. And he did it by integrating his crusades. That was a very important move in the South, I think. The major explosion between the new evangelicals and the strict fundamentalists came when Billy Graham accepted an invitation to hold an evangelistic crusade in New York City under the auspices of the Protestant Council, a group that was predominantly non-evangelical and even out-and-out liberals. That meant sending converts back to liberal churches, no matter how liberal those churches might be. And that was the split. That did it. Jack Wordson. Now, y'all never heard of Jack Wordson, but he was holding mass evangelistic crusades in Madison Square Garden before there was a Billy Graham. He founded Word of Life Camp in Schroon Lake, New York. Big name for years in the East. He was irate. John R. Rice, who through the spring of 1956 defended Graham from mounting fundamentalism criticism, asked Graham to reaffirm the fundamentalist statement of faith of the sword of the Lord. Graham responded by asking that his name be dropped from the cooperative board of the sword of the Lord. That was the split, the New York Crusade. When I became a Christian, this was a big issue. I mean, this was a big, big issue. That's all Christians talked about. Graham came to town, are you going to cooperate with Graham? And I'm thinking, huh? What? What's going on here? What's bad about Graham? You know? I knew nothing. I didn't grow up in all this stuff. In 1957, Graham answered his critics in a speech in the National Association, to the National Association of Evangelicals. He said, quote, "One badge of Christian discipleship is not orthodoxy, but love." Later that year, Carl Henry wrote that fundamentalism as a theology must be distinguished from fundamentalism as a temperament, meaning a harsh temperament. A split between love, a spirit of lovelessness and strife. By the time Graham opened the New York Crusade, quote, it was all over for the classic fundamentalist coalition. Although the shouting continued for two more decades, polemics on both sides prolificated as old fundamentalist communities sorted itself into two camps. The pivotal question was, what one thought of Billy Graham. Separatism, accordingly, now became the chief test of fundamentalism. So where that was a theological position, became a movement, and the issue was, do you believe in the five fundamentals of the faith? It's now, do you believe in separation from Billy Graham? And I'm telling you, I lived through that. That was the issue. That determined whether or not you were a fundamentalist. Or one of these new neo-evangelicals. And all I cared about, I just wanted to teach me how to teach the Bible, and I want to win people to Christ. I was an evangelist, and my head was spinning all these years about all this stuff, and I can tell you stories. All right. It was all over, except the shouting, which lasted for 2 days. Okay, they developed a polemic. The pivotal question was what they thought of Billy Graham. In his book, Reforming Fundamentalism, which I mentioned at the beginning, is my great source for all of this, Marsden notes, quote, Graham and Fuller Seminary were thrown into each other's arms. They were fully agreed that they had to jettison the counterproductive negativism of extreme fundamentalism and that they had to be open to sympathizers in ecumenical old line denominations, end of quote. In 1958, Graham became a board member of the Board of Trustees of Fuller Seminary, thus giving his endorsement to Fuller as the leading institution in the emerging New Evangelicalism Coalition. It was at this point that Akinjay released his press release giving the movement a distinctive identity and calling it the New Evangelicalism. The New Evangelicals claimed that they represented original fundamentalism, more than faithful than latter-day fundamentalists, which they added separation and unliving militancy and an insistence on the details of dispensationalism to the original evangelical defense of the fundamentals. So fundamentalism is going to adopt a new stance themselves. We're going to add things like militancy to it. We're going to become militant fundamentalists. For example, as the editor of Christianity Today, Carl Henry envisioned a return to a standard much like the fundamentals of 1910. He lined up an array of scholars as contributors to Christianity Today. Now, what I've done is take you from the beginning of New Evangelicalism to its split with fundamentalism. And that came as a result of the New York Crusade and Graham sending converts to liberal churches. I've been going for quite a while. Should we have a break? Let's take a quick break.